because all of them I'll stomp, bold and black, but I won't protect all of my followers because all I want is respect. I'm not a doctor, put him in rapture, a slick brother who can easy outfox ya, because I'm Rob, the last name Bashia, and on the mic, I'm known to be the freshest. So let's start, it shouldn't be too hard. I'm not a sucker, so I don't need a bodyguard. I won't fess, wear a bulletproof vest. Don't smoke Buddha, can't stand cess, yes. And with that, welcome to Early Stoppage, a show where the news of the day is usually given just enough time, but sometimes not enough. If this is your first time stopping by, we thank you, and get ready for something you won't find anywhere else. I'm John Franklin. I'm joined by Craig Allen, founder, content creator, face, and also engine of Fight Night Picks. On this episode of Early Stoppage, we talk about Gilbert Burns crossing lines, Sean O'Malley and Cody Garbrandt firing shots, and what's next for the Lioness. But we begin, Craig, with Dana White. And he might have to go see HR because he's had some issues with his quote-unquote coworkers. It started when Dan Le Batard was asking the tough questions, as he's wont to do, and then Dana challenged him to a fight. Actually, he challenged Dana to a fight which Dana accepted, and said he would donate $250,000 to charity to make it happen. But it was his time on First Take that really made the week for him. Dana got into it with Dominique Foxworth about labor. For context, Dominique Foxworth is a former NFL player, head of the Players Association, and a Harvard business graduate. The tense exchange between the two was mostly Foxworth saying, "I don't know, but it doesn't sound good," and Dana playing the owner of a fledgling business who's just trying to keep the doors open. Craig, if you had to sum this up in a meme, it would be, well, that escalated quickly. So my question is, what role will this exchange have in the future of labor negotiations in the UFC? Is it going to be a blip on the radar or the ignition for the entire labor movement?
It's not the ignition for the entire labor movement. And thanks for having me, John. Really excited to be here. I appreciate it. But yeah, in terms of that type of thing, no. I mean, you've had John Jones, Conor McGregor, Sean O'Malley, so a litany of fighters asking for more money. And now you have a learned business grad in Dominique Foxworth, who, not the biggest NFL guy, so I had to look into him a little bit, but a guy who knows his stuff anyway. And like he had said, and like you had said, a guy who has some dealings in terms of labor unions and sports contracts. And he didn't push too hard, but he pushed exactly hard enough, especially on a show like First Take. And I mean, if you had a guy like Stephen A, or if you had even Max Kellerman didn't push him as much. But you have a guy that's a little bit outside the lines in Dominique Foxworth asking these type of questions. I don't think it's the ignition. And I think it's definitely going to have a positive impact for not just the fighters, but the chance that, hey, maybe they unionize. This is a huge opportunity. And if you're Dana White, wouldn't you have seen this coming going on First Take like this? Like, shouldn't you have expected some type of pressure? Because Dominique Foxworth, Max Kellerman, they're ESPN guys. But you're not going to get questions like this from MMA media at an event. Yeah, you might get a little bit. I mean, Kevin Ioli pressed him here and there, and Dana was like, you know, I love you, but, and then he kind of went off on Kevin. And it was somewhat mild-mannered, but there was a little bit of ill intent there. You could tell Dominique Foxworth just wanted an answer, and he kind of pressed for it, but not too hard. I think it's a positive if you're a UFC fighter. You get a guy like this asking tough questions.
You know, it's interesting. You would think that UFC being business partners with Dana would go easy on him, but the thing that you have to respect about ESPN is that, and if I said the UFC business partners, I meant ESPN. The thing about ESPN that's cool is that traditionally they'll go after business partners. You know, they'll ask those tough questions. They found a way to sort of have like Outside the Lines and E60 and different ways to sort of broach some of these tougher subjects. My favorite line of all was when Dana said, "I'm not one of these owners crying about this, that, and the other." And then when he was talking about all his problems, Dominique Foxworth goes, "Well, you can't say you're not crying anymore." Dana, it kind of regressed into like schoolyard talk. I got a question for you to kind of further this discussion, which is kind of what we do like and start the conversation or what we do in sparring sessions. But this is what fascinates me. If you're Dana White, do you run away from Dominique Foxworth or do you run towards him? Because I think if UFC fighters got someone like Dominique Foxworth to start their labor union, that would be amazing. So if you're Dana, do you do the thing that Trump did when he got elected where you're like, let me bring all these people in so that I can tell everybody that I listened to them and then I never talk to them ever again? Do you play that card where you're like, you know, you bring Dominique Foxworth in, keep your enemies closer kind of a thing? What do you think?
Okay, this is the question, or at least this is the answer to the question that nobody's going after. We've already seen this happen with fighter pay and Dana White and ESPN, but it was somewhat indirect with ESPN. It was right when, it would have been, what, January 2019, in and around there, when UFC was headed to ESPN. So Dana was on First Take. He was on Greeny's show that I can't remember the name of because I'm a Canadian. I don't watch these ESPN sports shows, but I know who he is. Anyway, Dana White went on all these shows and he attacked Oscar De La Hoya because Oscar De La Hoya said that Dana White wasn't paying his fighters and he was paying Chuck and Tito all this money and this and that. What did Dana White do when Oscar De La Hoya went after him? He went after Oscar De La Hoya on all the biggest shows. He can't do that here. It's Dominique Foxworth. He's not an MMA guy. He's not a promoter. He's a guy who's involved in the back end of dealings with labor unions. And he's a smart guy that understands negotiations. Dana can't go after him. You could. But you're just going to make even more of a fool of yourself. So you just have to take your lumps, and he lost this one. That's how I feel on this. Because with Oscar De La Hoya, Oscar doesn't know. Oscar has no idea.
You know, so I'm watching a show right now called Ozark, and on this show, there's a lot of inner dealings and a lot of...
Don't you dare spoil that show. I've only
seen
season one.
I will not spoil it. There's a lot of things, deals that have to be made, a lot of things that have to happen, right? It's kind of like House of Cards. And listen, Dana's got the ultimate ally in the White House right now. He's buddies with Trump. And for however long that lasts, I think Dana thinks that he can push these things. The game that Dominique Foxworth plays is much different than the game Dana White's playing. He's in the fight game. And in the fight game, you can take shots at guys like De La Hoya and you go back and forth. Dominique Foxworth, if he really wanted to sort of go to war with Dana, he would unionize these guys. And I think that Dana has to see that's coming, and maybe he's just trying to delay it as long as he can, but it's bound to happen.
Like in a schoolyard, like I've got something to say here. There's two things about this. Dominique Foxworth, NFL guy on ESPN. So either A, he could try and push for a labor movement in MMA, or B, he just packs it up and goes home and doesn't care because it's on a TV show. So you can do one of two things. I think you're right. But in terms of having, you know, actual tangible goals or any, like, he doesn't have anything involved in the game so much. So, yeah, it was great fodder for TV, and it was overblown on Twitter. I mean, I didn't even watch this on ESPN. What was this, yesterday? It was on Tuesday, I believe. It was this huge deal. And then I watched it, and I thought, oh, that's the big deal? Like, big whoop. I've seen Dana White say worse things. That's it. That's all you got. All right. Fair
That's
enough.
It.
Let's continue on to more spicy topics. And John, get another gold watch ready and let's all sing for He's a Jolly Good Fellow, because after we lost Henry Cejudo to a for sure never going to be in the cage again retirement, Conor McGregor also hung them up on Twitter. John, if I asked you to give me a percentage of how much this is legit and how much of this is just a flex, where do you fall on that scale?
You know, I think this is the ultimate flex, and I think Conor does this all the time. So if I was going to say how much of it's legit and how much of it is a flex, I'll do the 80-20 rule. 80% of it's a flex and 20% of it might be legit. Conor has, you know, whatever you want to call it, generational money, FU money, he's paid, and he doesn't have too much to worry about. So if he wanted to walk away, he certainly could. But Conor, as much as anybody, understands that all this gamesmanship and all this back and forth and all this nonsense wastes his prime. So if this is a negotiating ploy, which I think it is, then here's what I think it is. I think that Conor is always active on social media after fights because he wants to remind Dana White that no matter what you do, I'm the biggest story if I tweet something out, right? No matter what you do, people are always talking about me after your fights. Dana had a tremendous card on UFC 250. And Conor was like, don't forget, I can still get the limelight when I want it. I think this is, I'm going 80. That might be a little conservative. This is for sure a flex to me.
Yeah, I think 80 is fair. You know, you look at Henry Cejudo and he kind of talked about it in more depth. There's certain verbiage that you have to use and actually say coming out of your mouth that you're actually retired. You can't just tweet you're retired and then that's it. Oh, you know, that's law. So anyway, you look at Conor McGregor, He's ranked fourth in the UFC's lightweight rankings. He's ranked eighth in the pound-for-pound rankings. His last win at lightweight was in November of 2016. So everything's absolutely ridiculous and bonkers when we're talking about Conor McGregor, and nothing makes any sense. But in terms of an actual retirement, no, I don't think this is legit, as they say. There's no way. I mean, with Henry Cejudo, Olympic champ at 21, UFC champion, what, 32, 33, defends the belt, and then see you later. It makes sense. He's accomplished everything. I mean, yeah, has he made the you know, crazy amounts of money that Conor McGregor has? No. But he's teased a fight with Ryan Garcia in boxing. He's teased a Volkanovski fight in MMA. There's still certain opportunities, but for him, it felt more legitimate than anything. He needed a break. He needed a rest. He has his first girlfriend, so kudos to him. But for Conor McGregor, he already has so much money from the Mayweather fight, which translated over into the Proper 12 whiskey business. He doesn't need the money. He just wants the competition. And that's been more the narrative that I've seen. It's the fact that I'm retiring, but wait, it's because they don't have fights for me. So it's kind of an awkward spot. But where he's ranked so highly in the lower weight class, being lightweight, maybe it's all just a ploy to try and get a fight with Khabib. But it's looking like that fight's not going to happen anytime soon.
Yeah, I think that he's smart to play things the way he does, in the sense that it's Khabib or nothing at 55. So Dana came out and said, I offered him to fill in for Ferguson and Khabib. He chose not to. I think that he needs to be 100% on his game to fight Khabib. He could probably be 80 or 90 for everybody else in the world. But, yeah, so I think that that's sort of a little bit of gamesmanship between him and Dana, just to say, you know, he says he's retiring. Dana says, well, listen, he had a chance to not be retired. If he says he's retiring because he doesn't want fights, I offered him this fight, he didn't take it. I don't think that Conor really wants a fight that's going to get in the way of, to me, it's three people. It's three people in the entire world, Craig. It's Khabib, it's Kamaru Usman, and it's Jorge Masvidal. They're the only three people in the world that have anything Conor wants. Anybody else is just proving things that have already been proven. If he beats Justin Gaethje, what does he get? You're tough. Conor wants things to hang on the wall. We already know he's tough. Beating Justin Gaethje makes you some sort of uncrowned champion, or gives you some sort of distinction.
You're telling me he doesn't want to be the lineal WSOF lightweight champion? Is that what you're telling me?
I think he's going to go ahead and opt out of that title, yeah.
Shoot.
All right, Craig, let's talk about that 170-pound division. Well, Jorge Masvidal pushed all his chips into the middle of the table, and it turns out he was Matt Damon at the beginning of Rounders, and Gilbert Burns was Teddy KGB. Burns booked the fight, and Masvidal's gamble at this point has come up snake eyes. I know I am mixing gambling metaphors here, but the question is, what does Jorge Masvidal have to do for the UFC to pay this man his money? You got a Teddy KGB impression out of me. Not a great one, but you got one.
We are to you, me and John. It's my best John Malkovich and Russian there. Yeah, what do you have to do for Jorge Masvidal? So you had his last fight, which involved the President of the United States, The Rock, Roberto Duran. There was a lot going on there. So what's next? I mean, is that the pinnacle? No. I mean, he truly wants the real gold. He doesn't want the silver or what was it? Was it pewter? What did they make that belt out of? It wasn't much. Regardless, he really wants that title fight. But at the same time, he's in here, and it's kind of our first question off the hop. Is he trying to do what we talked about last week, where the champions take a little bit less, everybody else gets paid a little bit more? Does he have true intentions? Is he going for the moral high ground here? I honestly think he is. So what do they have to do for the UFC to pay him? I honestly don't know. I think him doing what he's doing right now, going out on the big shows, going on ESPN, where there's so much friction and this and that, I think it's the noble thing to do to get the title fight. It's already been there. It's already been offered. So all he had to do was sign on the dotted line. Realistically, I think he has to continue in the pursuits that he's already begun. Maybe you get John Jones on your side. I honestly don't know. And for Gilbert Burns too, I can see it both ways. Is it a little underhanded that he took the fight? Yeah. But if you're Gilbert Burns and you're 33 years old at welterweight, you take that fight. A lot of people pointed out, like, this is a guy, his last loss was a finish to Dan Hooker at lightweight. He gets another one at lightweight. He moves up to welterweight. You're fighting guys like Alexei Kunchenko, and then all of a sudden you're on the fast track and you're beating Tyron Woodley and making him look like he doesn't even you know, belong in the UFC, you have to take that chance if you're Gilbert Burns. So I understand, you know, kind of his perspective. Yeah, you need that fight against Usman. Win or lose, you fought for a world title in the UFC. That's huge. But if you're Jorge Masvidal, I honestly don't really have a good answer here.
Well, here's what makes it interesting with the Jorge Masvidal thing. If you're the UFC, you're kind of talking out of both sides of your mouth. And what I mean by that is you can't say that we should put value on belts. And you can't tell me that Kamaru Usman is a star and I should care about him and I should tune in when he fights if you're paying Jorge Masvidal less money to fight Kamaru Usman for the real belt than you paid him to fight Nate Diaz for some fake belt. And you can't tell me that Nate Diaz isn't worth having in the UFC and he's here, he's there, who cares? If he got you know, brought about a bigger payday for Jorge Masvidal. So either Masvidal's worth it, right, on his own, that he should get paid the money to fight Usman that he got paid to fight Diaz. Or now you're telling me you're comparing Nate Diaz and Kamaru Usman. So you can't tell me that some Diaz brother who's never held a belt has more value than your 170-pound champion. You can't – if you're the UFC, you got to understand that, listen, not everybody's going to dig into the logic like you and I do, which is what they're banking on. They're banking on casuals just going, I like Nate Diaz. I don't like Kamaru Usman. Okay, easy choice. And I get that. And really, honestly, Craig, that's what it boils down to.
Oh, yeah.
How fans feel. But my point is that that's very hard for a fighter to swallow.
I've had to learn this the hard way because the way that I view MMA, I view it through a lens of I'm on Twitter all the time. So everybody must be on Twitter all the time. And they have this deep, deep connection where they know that Haulian Paiva is going to be fighting Shalash Shumagulov on UFC 251 on the prelims. And they know who Shumagulov is. And they know that Paiva is a great striker. And they're so excited about that fight. I live in this weird bubble world where I just think that everybody thinks like that. But no, MMA exists not just in the fringes on Twitter, but on the Instagrams and on the Facebooks. And that's where you're really drawing in that audience. And like you said, they're hardcore for the Nate Diaz's, the big, big, big names. And maybe Kamaru Usman, if you're Usman, yeah, you're not that big of a draw. Maybe you're not that big guy that a lot of people on Twitter believe you to be. So yeah, it's an awkward type of conversation, and it's one that's going to continue moving forward because, yes, we have other sports coming back, but again, as Dana White loves to point out, we're the only ones that are back. We're the only ones that are having events. You're going to draw all the scrutiny in that case.
You know, one piece of advice I'll give fans and fighters, fans and MMA media, is that, you know, Twitter's funny. When you're not on Twitter for like a day or so, you don't think that anything happened on Twitter while you were gone. You only exist in the world that you view. Right? You're like, this is all that's going on right now. And unless you go back in your timeline, which I don't really too much tend to do. I kind of stick to whatever's happening when I'm on there, which is a really narrow view. But it is interesting that if you look on like some of these Facebook groups, or like you said, Instagram, it is a different consumption of the sport. And I think that sometimes, you know, you and I, like you said, are guilty of it. We get so locked into what's happening on our Twitter, which is basically just the people we're following who are in MMA media, you know, or fighters or whoever, that sometimes you forget, you don't see the long game. I'm with you.
Okay, so let's parlay all of this into the next one. And it was an interesting week for Daniel Cormier as he was on DC and Ariel caping for UFC. And it's awkward for him because, again, he's on ESPN, but he's a broadcaster. He does play-by-play for the UFC. And he's telling fighters to be more direct and not use the media to get what they want. And then the next thing you know, he's got the Stipe fight. Now, I'm not a complete conspiracy theory guy, so I won't say one has to do with the other. But is DC in touch with the fighters who are the most affected by the UFC's labor practices? Or is this like asking Bill Gates how much a gallon of milk costs?
You know, I that's an extreme example, and I know that I'm the one that provided the example. But it's for me, I do think that he operates in a different world. You know, he has access to Dana whenever he wants, I'm sure. He has access to all the fighters. You know, DC lives in a world where all the ropes, the velvet ropes, are open when he comes, especially in MMA. I think that he is, it's tough because he has had a very unique experience. He's always been in the high-level gym. So he's always had, like, Javier Mendez, Cain Velasquez, and John Fitch. He's always had people around him that kind of, you know, had ins in the UFC, had relationships in the UFC. So he had access from a very early time in his career in a way that not everyone does. You know, I would argue that even, you know, Fortis MMA is one of the bigger gyms, you know, up and coming. Their fighters can't get Dana on the phone when they want. Their fighters can't. I don't even know if their coach can. So I do think that Cormier is giving some advice that maybe not everyone can follow. He did get what he wanted in this case, but he's had to do a lot of stuff and been through a lot of things to get the things that he wanted.
I mean, we just had UFC 250. When Daniel Cormier, John Jones won was what, UFC 182. So it's been a minute since they fought for the first time. And even before then, Daniel Cormier was on the forefront of a lot of people's minds. I mean, undefeated, Strikeforce champ. He was the alternate. And the UFC makes a move to light heavyweight, finds a ton of success. This is a guy that, even before that, I mean, when you're talking Oklahoma State, such a stud wrestler, you pretty much have your choice of camps. And then the other thing that gets weird, and this is where I can see it from both sides, if he's the head coach or the guy that's leading at AKA, you got to take that with an asterisk. That's with the pros, and you probably are only going to get the pros, the top 1%. You're not going to find guys that are, you know, the first on the prelims of like a Bellator card or even some of the UFC Fight Night cards, like this weekend where you get Anthony Ivey taking on Christian Aguilera, both making their UFC debuts. Like, you're not going to have guys like that that are making 10 and 10. So I can see it from both ways. He definitely probably does have relationships with fighters like that. But at the same time, he's at this odd spot in his career where it's Stipe or bust, and they've held out for so long to get that fight. So I'm sure he can kind of see it from both ways. But at the same time, when you're on ESPN and you also have a commentary gig with the UFC, you kind of have to be a company man when old man retirement is knocking on the wall, I guess.
Yeah, and the other thing is, it's interesting. I'm not saying that he doesn't have access. You know, Deron Wynn is one of the guys that he's very close with, and he's Deron Wynn's a prelim guy. And so, I mean, I'm with you that he is someone who has access to those guys, maybe understands some of their problems. My point is that when he gives advice like that, he has to understand
it's not kind of tone deaf.
Well, but you have to understand it's not as easy for everybody. That'd be like if Brad Pitt came up to you and said, you know, if you want to date the most beautiful girl on a barge, walk up to her and say hi. When you're Brad Pitt, that's a little bit easier Brad Pitt.
What are you saying? When you're Daniel Cormier. What are you saying?
No, I'm just saying that Daniel Cormier could take the direct approach. He's one of the best fighters of all time. All right, Craig, we have a problem on our hands.
Yeah, apparently I can't just walk into a bar and say whatever I want.
You can't just walk into a bar. That's the problem on your hands. You can't just walk into a bar and say whatever you want. We have a problem on our hands, or more specifically, the UFC does. Amanda Nunes is giving everyone they put in front of her the business. She's becoming a victim of her own success, as the dance partners are few and far between. Short of handicap matches where we send 2 and 3 ladies in there, what should we do with the Lioness moving forward? Is she just someone who we're just going to kind of celebrate her greatness and throw people at her? I mean, we got to a place with Ronda like that where we didn't think people could beat her, and we kept throwing people at her, and then somebody kicked her head into the first row, and here we are. So
yeah,
what do we do with her?
Yeah, it was Amanda Nunes that kicked her head. Well, actually, it was Holly Holm. Then it was Amanda Nunes. But yeah, I mean, I'm fine if you want to throw Aspen Ladd in there, and then when she gets tired, you throw in Betch. Realistically, the fight to make is that the winner of Irene Aldana and Holly Holm. That's the fight that they're trying to make. And from what I've read on Twitter, and again, narrow-minded Twitter, is the fact that, yeah, if Holly Holm wins that fight, like, she is actually going to get a title shot. It's something they've talked about. For Aldana, I'd like to see her as the next challenger. She has looked really good lately. But apart from that, what do you do? Like, at featherweight, well, there's Megan Anderson. There's Norma Dumont. There's Zara Farron. That's pretty much it, unless you want to throw poor Felicia Spencer back out there. And you can market it as, oh, this is the first Canadian since George St. Pierre to get 2 title shots. Like, at 135, there's a little bit more juice, but they're still not there yet. I mean, at least with Ronda Rousey, you can kind of make a case, but, yeah, you know, near the end, I guess. But Holly Holm was a huge underdog. I honestly don't know. That's the only likely scenario that I can see. Plus, you have to consider the fact that Nina Ansarov has got to be due somewhat soon, like over the summer, I would think. So once they have their first child, probably both going to take an extended period of time. So does that give the division time to catch up? Maybe the winner of Aldana and Holm either has to wait or fight again? I mean, these are all questions I guess I have. But for me, it has to be the winner of that fight.
Yeah, that seems like the writing on the wall. The problem with the home thing is obviously she's only two fights removed. If you count this fight from getting TKO by Amanda Nunes, which isn't great. And so you're kind of crossing your fingers on Aldana. But I think for me, it's, like you said, with Nina Ansaroff being due soon, I think you just give her a nice check. The UFC talks about these discretionary bonuses. And they go, listen, we can't find anybody for you. You're having a baby. Whatever you would get paid in the next fight that you would get booked, here's the money for it. Just take a walk, raise your kid for a little bit, and then we'll see you in a year or so. Stay in the gym, but, you know, we're wasting our time here really trying to put somebody in front of you. And like I said, unless it's Aldana. And I think that Aldana has to just pray that she's so wrapped up in the pregnancy and the birth that she catches her on a super off night. But I don't expect that to happen. But, you know, that's where you're at. I mean, she's kind of riding things out now.
Interim bantamweight championships. That's what we need. And we move along. And, John, this is actually something that I looked into quite a bit before the show. And The Last Dance, well, I knew about that, was a massive hit for ESPN. And content providers were certainly watching. Now, all of a sudden, the PFL is launching PFL Studios, which has a lot of content. But it also includes a several-part documentary on UFC Hall of Famer Randy Couture, and it's a nice side shot, and there's wording next to his head. He looks like he's peering off into the distance. What do you think about the PFL doing this?
Here's where it gets tricky. I love it. I love everything the PFL does. Let me just say that. I really do. And I wish that the PFL would just go ahead and get bought out by UFC, but keep the PFL. Just buy them. And make them a feeder league. It's the easiest decision to make. It really is. Because the problem is, if you're the UFC and you buy the PFL, and now they have PFL Studios, here's what you do. You already own all the content in mixed martial arts history anyway, in terms of they bought all these fight libraries up, right? They own all that stuff. So they're going to make it tough on the PFL to do anything anyway. So I love the idea of this Randy Couture documentary, but unless PFL is willing to pay for the rights for all his UFC fights, the thing's probably going to fall short. So I love that they're doing this. I just hope they can find a partnership with the UFC, at least in content.
It gets awkward, and not to kind of stray away too far from the Randy Couture stuff, I'll bring it back, but they're going to have like an inside the studio. They're going to have like a 24/7 type of show, or if you're familiar with the NHL Road to the Winter Classic, where they go behind the scenes, but it's not current. They're going to go back to 2019 and kind of review the whole season. And they're talking about 8 fights in a 5-month span. And then they're going to do a show with champions. But did you see who the champions were? They're their biggest 3 champions: Lance Palmer, Kayla Harrison, Ray Cooper III. Who outside of PFL fans? And PFL fans have to be, what, the most vocal people on Twitter, maybe? And they are few and far between. Who cares about Ray Cooper III, Kayla Harrison, and Lance Palmer? I do. But the mass audience probably doesn't. I mean, look at the competition that you had in the last season of the PFL, which was created just to make Kayla Harrison a champion. Larissa Pacheco, who didn't have a great UFC career. Sarah Kaufman, who, you know, all 10 Canadian PFL fans were behind. And apart from that, there wasn't really a whole lot, because at women's lightweight, you don't have a ton of fighters. You're pretty hard-pressed to find somebody. To bring it back, if the PFL wants to profit off of the successes that Randy Couture had 15 years ago, let them. I think I actually like it. I can see from your face that you really are indifferent to my answer. And if you're listening on audio, John's making a nasty face. But I'm looking forward to this. It's just, who's going to watch it? You're going to watch it. I'm going to watch it. 15 people might watch it. What would you cap their audience at? Under 1,000?
About that, yeah. I'm not indifferent to your answer. I guess this is an interesting case study for me in content.
Now,
if you and I lived, and I a little bit more so than you, but if lived in a city with a lot of MMA, right? Let's say I quit my job, I stopped teaching, and I decided I was going to provide content. The question would become, how much content can I create where the focus of the content is a bunch of people no one knows, right? So, like, if I wanted to just...
It didn't work.
Well, here's the thing. If I wanted to just go to all the regional shows here in Phoenix, and I got all the best software, I got all the greatest cameras, and I wanted to tell the guy that owned those regional promotions, the guys that owns the regional promotions, I'm going to film your stuff. I'm going to go ahead and give it, the business. I'm going to give it the treatment, right? In the end, would anyone care how well produced content is? Again, with people that you don't know, I mean, Kayla Harrison's a star. They have some people, but Justin, I'm going to steal the old Rick Pitino line. Justin Gaethje's not walking through that door, folks. You know what I'm saying? That they don't have who they used to have.
No, Marlon
Moraes is not walking through that door. So my point is like, is anybody going to care? Because listen, full disclosure, keeping it 100, they are doing really well at their content. They are doing some stuff, run it back. They're making huge, they're taking Sean O'Connell and really using him. They're riding that kid till the wheels come off. And like, I like what they're doing. But in the end, you're watching PFL fighters. And I'm not trying to throw shade on them, but that's what it is.
Yeah, it's it'd be like watching the AHL or AAA baseball and then saying, wow, you know what? I really like the fact that they don't have umpires. Balls and strikes are counted by a computer. Well, that's awesome. But is anybody really watching? No. So until they start doing stuff like that in the big leagues, does anybody care? I think it's a good point. I think they'd be a perfect feeder league for the UFC if they signed them to be a AAA or an AHL or whatever sport reference you want to make here, the minor leagues. But the other thing is they're putting so much into their content. They're putting out such a good product. Maybe they will attract a bigger audience. And hopefully for them, they do, because ratings-wise, not that great.
I agree. All right, let's move on to sparring sessions. Craig, you kind of stepped on this a little bit earlier, but we'll go with it still. Gilbert Burns has been awarded a title shot against Kamaru Usman for what seems ostensibly as just agreeing to the terms that Jorge Masvidal would not. There's a lot to unpack here. One, should Gilbert Burns be expected to not take a lower number for the good of the cause? Should he be some sort of martyr for the labor movement? Two, is Gilbert Burns even worth what Jorge Masvidal is? So should he get the same offer that Jorge Masvidal gets? And if he gets a lower offer that's commensurate with what he should get paid, why should he turn it down? And lastly, isn't the belt the ultimate bargaining chip? So my question to you is, in the end, do you think with – I know what you said earlier, but with all that now taken into account, do you think Burns handled the situation properly? What does he owe anyone other than himself?
So Gilbert Burns' last loss was July 2018. Dan Hooker got knocked out in the first round. He keeps winning. He lost to Tommy Langacare. I don't watch a lot of this jiu-jitsu stuff. At Polaris 12. And Craig Jones at Submission Underground 10. Well, that's to be expected. And then he beat Damian Maia and Tyron Woodley. Now he gets a title shot. Does he owe anybody anything? No. He doesn't owe anybody anything at all. No. If I were him, and I'm on the precipice of 34 in mixed martial arts, where I'm getting my head beat in, how many chances do you get at a belt? Not many, unless you're Demian Maia at 170 and 185. That's my reference to Demian Maia this week. No, he doesn't owe anybody anything. I mean, like, how many fighters on the come up late in their career would pull a stunt where they're going to say, hey, no, you know what? I'm not going to take the money. Okay, so if Gilbert Burns does it and Jorge Masvidal does it, who's the next one? Leon Edwards. Well, he's in the UK, but now Fight Island's in Abu Dhabi. You think Leon Edwards is going to hop on a plane and fight for a belt? Yeah, probably. If he can leave and he can go there safely, yeah, he's going to do it. And then after that, we continue on down the list. Do you think multiple fighters are going to say no? Probably not. Eventually, you're going to land on somebody. So did Burns handle the situation properly? I think he did. Shots like this don't come, you know, very often. And once you have that title fight, that's always going to be right there. Win or lose, Anthony Smith fought for a title. He got beaten up pretty bad. Alexander Gustafsson's had a lot of title fights. People still like Alexander Gustafsson and want him to fight Verdum at heavyweight. So once you have that attached to your name, it definitely means something. If you're Burns, you have to do it.
I agree and I disagree in the sense that I understand where you're coming from, but here's my take. I want to read to you Nate Diaz's tweet this week, and then I want to tell you my quote tweet and where all this this all becomes interconnected. Nate Diaz tweeted, "This is what's wrong with people claiming they're fighters settling for less because they know they're not worth shit. You should have fought the next guy in line, not the guy who would take less because he's told to. That's why no one will remember you guys. This isn't a title fight." To which I quote tweeted, The reason there will never be a fighters union is because there will always be a quote-unquote Gilbert Burns. There will always be someone who is willing to take the fight for less money. But again, this is where the discussion gets nuanced, and this is why I would like to talk to a Dominique Foxworth or somebody like that. If you, let's say that Jorge Masvidal's number is $1 million. Let's just keep it nice and round. Jorge Masvidal's number to fight Kamaru Usman is $1 million. What if Gilbert Burns says, I'd fight him for $750,000 because that's what I think I'm worth? Isn't that fair of Gilbert Burns? Like, isn't it fair for him to say, I'm not a $1 million fighter? This, maybe this is a $1 million shot. Do you follow me?
Yeah,
why
I
can
do,
we ask him?
Yeah, I get it, but it gets complicated. So you're Gilbert Burns. You just fought. When did Jorge Masvidal fight? The end of last year? Yeah, it's been a while. Gilbert Burns still fresh. Gilbert Burns has a camp to pay. He goes to Hard Knocks 365. I mean, yeah, Masvidal goes to ATT and they're what, like 20 minutes away, 25 minutes away? But still, point being, Gilbert Burns is fight ready right now and he can hop on a plane and fight for a world title tomorrow. Jorge Masvidal probably stays in really good shape, but he's not going to be the finely tuned Masvidal to beat Diaz, to beat Till, to beat whoever you want to name here. So there, you have to take little things like that into account. And at the same time, where do you want Gilbert Burns to start this discourse? On Twitter? Because look what we're talking about on Twitter. Is Conor McGregor really retired because he said he was on Twitter? No. So you have to, A, put your money where your mouth is. Do it in a pretty public form. Get Gilbert Burns on ESPN. Well, are they going to have Gilbert Burns on ESPN? Probably not until right before he has the world title fight. And the other thing that you have to consider is management as well. It's not like Gilbert Burns is negotiating these contracts himself. He's not Sean O'Malley who left Ruby Sports. He's Gilbert Burns who has his own manager. So if your manager comes to you and offers you this, they're probably not going to say, hey, you should hold out. They're going to say, hey, take this opportunity.
Yeah, and lastly, let's talk about this. It's not Gilbert Burns' responsibility to fight Jorge Masvidal's battles. And with this respect, when Jorge Masvidal, in 2019, he fought Darren Till in March, he fought Ben Askren in July, and he fought Nate Diaz in November. I guarantee you that the payday for the November fight was different than the payday for the March fight. And as he was ascending, he wasn't getting paid what he wanted to because he didn't have leverage. Well, Gilbert Burns doesn't have leverage right now, really. Because Jorge Masvidal exists and because all these other guys are out there. So I understand that all these guys need to band together for there to be some sort of a positive labor situation. I just don't know that, you know, Gilbert Burns needs to be Curt Flood here.
Yeah, I agree with you. And I want to move on to my low-key favorite segment. And if this is the first time that you're watching Early Stoppage and you have to watch for this portion, and this is definitely going to be clipped, so you'll find it on the internet. Hopefully you like it as much as I do. Now, it's called Hitting the Speed Bag, and John, we're putting 2 minutes on the timer, and I'm going to ask you five totally random MMA questions. So, John wasn't privy to these questions before the show. John, are you ready?
I'm as ready as I ever am for this. It scares the hell out of me because I never know the questions. You go, I ask you stuff like who's four fighters you'd want to have dinner with, or who's the best dead fighter you'd want to arm wrestle, like ridiculous questions. And then you ask me like, you know, who has the most solid, you know, ground game. Yes, I'm as ready as I'm going
to
be.
I showed up with a signed Butterbean boxing glove. I'm ready to go. So first question, clearly, John, starting the timer right now. Amid the additions to UFC 251, one that's flying well under the radar is a flyweight booking between Howley and Paiva and former Fight Nights global champ, Jalal Shumagulov. I brought these guys up before. If Shumagulov's full name was thrown down on a Scrabble board, what would the Scrabble score be?
Oh, wow. I'm not even that much of a Scrabble player, but I would say 26.
48. It's rumored that Mike Tyson turned down an $18 million payday.
That's the best question you've ever asked me. Good.
To fight Wanderlei Silva and is instead focusing on returning to traditional boxing. If BKFC made an offer to you to fight either Mike Tyson or Wanderlei Silva, who would you choose and how much money would you need?
How much money would it take for me to fight either Mike Tyson or Wanderlei Silva in bare knuckle fighting?
In bare knuckle.
I would fight Wanderlei Silva because Mike Tyson is – there's a saying that goes, even tough guys are scared of crazy guys, right? So Mike Tyson is tough and he's crazy. Wanderlei Silva is just tough. So I would rather fight a tough guy than a crazy guy.
You'd rather long story fight, short. You'd rather fight a guy with the nickname the Axe Murderer. That's fair. Number three.
I didn't let me give you my number. I'd fight him. I'd fight Wanderlei Silva for $1 million.
Oh, I'd fight him for less than that. 15,000. Joe Rogan has all of a sudden turned into a big advocate for Trevor Whitman's Onyx sports gear, MMA gear designed for the mixed martial artist. If you're a fighter or a coach, what's the one piece of gear that needs to change in MMA?
Gloves.
How so?
The fingers. I'm an advocate of the, I'm an advocate of the pride gloves.
Okay. It was announced that Clay Guida is going to be taking on Bobby Green on the June 20th UFC card from Vegas. That's as Just Bleed as it gets. If you could match make a Just Bleed booking in 2020 with fighters past and present, what's your pick?
You know what's funny? I say this all the time. Side note, my birthday is June 19th, so this Clay Guida Bobby Green fight's kind of a late birthday present. But I would, you know what's funny? I say that these two are related, father and son, as a joke on Twitter all the time. I'd want to see Mike Perry fight Phil Baroni for 1,000 reasons, but that's as Just Bleed as it gets for me.
I like
Perry and Phil Baroni.
NYBA and Florida Zone. Fifth question, rabbit hole question. We talked about the names last week, I believe. But who would be the best to head a fighters union? Conor McGregor, Chael Sonnen, Daniel Cormier were three big names, but we talked about one of them being out of touch in this episode. Who would get your vote?
Dominic Cruz.
Good answer.
Because he's relentless and he's well spoken.
And he gets kicked in the leg and loses fights. I think
the other guys are a little bit in the bag for Dana. I don't think Dominic, even though he's the ESPN guy. I don't think he's in the back for Dana.
What was that TV show that they did like 10 years ago about AKA?
I don't remember.
I'm going to have to dig this up because it focused on like Cain Velasquez. It was like Fight Factory, I think was the name of it.
That sounds right. Yeah.
Yeah. And you brought up the name already, but they had a fighter who was already long in the tooth and he was like trying to work his way back, but they wouldn't let him into AKA. What if you had Phil Baroni as the head of your fighters unit?
That'd be
I just want one more, coach.
All right, let's move on to kind of a new segment. You know, it's funny. We vary our segments so much that sometimes I forget what's new and what's not. If it's a new idea or it's not. I think this is new. I'm calling this segment Shots Fired. Basically, I'm going to ask you about a couple of scenarios. You tell me if you think that this person was just keeping it 100 or if they were just – if they were firing shots, if they were trying to make a point. One takeaway from UFC 250 is that bantamweight division is super healthy. Dana had a 135-pound heavy card, which is an odd sentence to be constructed. Is this just the way the chips fell for Dana, or is this Dana firing shots at Cejudo for retiring?
It's the perfect storm, and that's a cop-out answer, but Cejudo retires. Who's your number one contender? Is it Sterling? Is it Sandhagen? Then you have Piotr Jan fighting Jose Aldo. Then you have Sean O'Malley fighting the WEC legend in Eddie Wineland. I mean, it was a great card. It was a lot of great bookings. Is it just the way the chips fell? It's probably due to circumstance. So maybe I'll say Dana firing shots at Cejudo, but did he really accomplish anything? I'm pretty sure Henry Cejudo is doing just fine.
No, I guess I just meant, is this him saying that the 135-pound division is just fine, see you later?
Yeah, I mean, and according to TJ Dillashaw months ago, when he comes back, he gets a title shot. So it's a weird division. Why not?
All right, Craig, John Jones took to Twitter to discuss his salary history with the UFC. And he said a lot, including that he got a Bentley for his fight with Machida and not so much fair pay. Is this Jones keeping it 100 or is this shots fired?
That's shots fired. That's, hey, I was young and dumb and a Bentley's cool, so I'm going to take it. And now that he's older and wiser, even though he still makes mistakes, but he's wiser, he realizes that, man, I should have. Money's a lot better than a car. What's the liquid value on a Bentley after it rolls off the lot? Probably half.
Well, do you think this is the shots fired at Dana, though?
Oh, yeah, 100%.
All right. I agree. Craig, Cody Garbrandt, Sugar Sean O'Malley have exchanged shade over each other's respective performances, their career trajectory at the age of 25, and chances they will fight each other. Are these bantamweights just keeping it 100, or is this shots fired?
They're keeping it 100, but I don't want to see that fight. That fight's really stupid. Have Sean O'Malley fight like a 10 to 15 guy. The fight that I want to see, you want a heavy-handed guy that's a little speedier and better than Eddie Wineland at this point. Put him up against Rob Font. That's the fight that I want. And let Cody Garbrandt fight somebody who's not going to punch him unconscious. So maybe not Corey Sandhagen, but somebody that's still up there. I guess they're keeping it 100, but yeah, I don't want that fight.
I'm with you. I think they're keeping it 100. I don't think that they have been saying what they've been saying to promote a fight. I think Sean O'Malley wouldn't mind having that fight, but had you asked him before the fight, if you'd asked him before the card, who of the on this card would you like to fight after this card? Cody Garbrandt probably would have been the last name he said. And I think that, you know, Garbrandt doesn't like how much shine O'Malley's getting. So he was just saying, listen, I was a world champion at 25. Don't compare me to this kid. And O'Malley's like, listen, he doesn't want to fight me. So I think they're keeping 100 as well.
Or Sean O'Malley already had an answer prepped, win or lose, for Cody Garbrandt, and he just stuck with it.
There you go. All right, lastly, in one of his videos, Chael Sonnen basically told fighters, here's our Chael mention of the week, you do not want to go up against the UFC because you won't win. Is this Chael keeping it 100 and actually really looking out for fighters? Or is he speaking kind of like as a proxy for Dana White and firing shots? Like, hey, this is not the battle you want.
It's awkward because they've sparred before, but Chael's with ESPN, but he's a commentator for Bellator and he last fought for Bellator. So that's where it gets hairy. Also, the fact that not that long ago, like in the last 6 to 8 months, I said that Chael Sonnen would be a good president for the UFC, even though he has, what was it, insider trading? Was it security issues that he had or securities issues that he had? So that probably won't happen.
He had a visit from some folks with the SEC.
Yeah.
He maybe got privy to some information before he should have.
We're not talking football. I guess he's keeping it 100. I mean, you got to think that guy's YouTube page is what, 2 or 3 times bigger than Fight Night Picks? It's only a little bit bigger, right? So it casts a fairly wide net. No, it casts a huge net. It's one of the biggest MMA pages out there. So there's going to be a lot of people that listen to that. But at the same time, there's got to be where there's smoke, there's fire. So there's got to be a little bit of a shot at Dana there.
Bonus one that I forgot to include. Dominic Reyes said that John Jones is doing everything he can to avoid him. I didn't include this one initially because it's kind of an open shut case, no brainer. Do you think that he's firing shots? Do you think that he's kind of moved on from John at this point? Or do you think that he's always going to be the goal for Reyes?
I mean, the big tweet that's out there with 12,000 likes from 6 hours ago. And I wasn't privy to this question before we started, but a guy posted underneath one of John Jones' posts with a picture of Dominic Reyes hitting an uppercut on John Jones. And Jones' retweet comment was, LOL, I hate that stuff. And a lot of people liked it. So is he trying to stay away from that fight? Well, it was the closest one that he's had, even though you could argue that the Thiago Santos one was, because it was a split decision, not a unanimous decision. That's neither here nor there. I think he wants to move to heavyweight. It's just not really in the cards because you've got Cormier fighting Stipe. He probably doesn't want to fight Ngannou the first fight there. So keeping it 100, I guess.
Yeah, I think that, you know, the Jones situation is kind of weird at this point. He's talked about Ngannou. I think he's keeping Ngannou kind of in a holding pattern in case Cormier beats Stipe. And he fights Ngannou either for an interim belt or I think the fight that everybody wants is for Stipe to beat Cormier and Jones to fight Stipe. I think that's the fight. All right, we've come to the time where it's time to power rank. There was a lot of fight announcements this week. I'm going to let you go first because I'm going to do this kind of in an odd way because I do things in odd ways.
Yep.
But
okay.
I want to power rank the fight announcements of the week. I'm going to read them to you and then you can give me what you think.
I'll just give you the number one off the top of my head. It's a fight at flyweight on the prelims of UFC 251. It's Khalid Paiva and Jalash Umagulov from Fight Nights Global. And Jalash Umagulov, if you don't know him, he won the Fight Nights Global flyweight title with a win over Ali Bagatinov in his last fight. Ali Bagatinov, that fought Demetrius Johnson way back when. Continue.
And again, how much is his name worth on Scrabble?
48 points for Jalash Umagulov. So you're going to have one of those out there first. Somebody either had to throw out Jalash or Umagulov.
Got it. All right, let's go through these fights. These are the fights that I chose. If there's a fight I'm missing, let me know. Kamaru Usman versus Gilbert Burns. Mike Perry against Mickey Gall. Holly Holm versus Irene Aldana. Derek Brunson versus Edmund Shabazian. Max Holloway versus Alexander Volkanovski. Stipe Miocic versus Daniel Cormier 3. Khabib versus Justin Gaethje. And Petr Yan versus Jose Aldo.
So when you look at fight announcements, it goes on a scale, and I've talked about this enough that if you're a Fight Night Picks fan, you've heard me say it, but it's a quote from Luis Smolka, and you want those type of fights to pucker your butthole. So on the scale of does it pucker my butthole or not, on the Luis Smolka scale, Mike Perry and Mickey Gall is pretty low. But Miocic Cormier is probably number one. I mean, that's the fight that I need to see. It's going to cap both of their careers, I would think. And they've each knocked each other out once. So what's going to happen in the third one? That's my number one there.
Go through your whole list.
And oh, okay. So that's number one. Number two, probably Khabib Nurmagomedov and Justin Gaethje. How's Khabib going to handle the leg kicks? Is he going to take him down and wrestle him? Justin Gaethje's a pretty good wrestler. That's number two. Number three, for name value, again, it's probably Max Holloway, Volkanovski. That was a close fight. I didn't think Holloway won by any stretch of the imagination, but will it end up differently? Who knows? Then I would say probably Jan and Aldo. It's a great stylistic matchup, though I don't think that Jose Aldo deserves a shot, and I'm surprised that I'd even consider this my fourth pick. Then Usman Burns. I don't think Burns has a snowball's chance in hell to beat Kamaru Usman, but it's an interesting fight. You can sell the fact they're teammates. Then Brunson Shabazian, because it's knockout or get knocked out there, or Edmund Shabazian, like in the Darren Stewart fight, tires himself out. Then Holly Holm, Irene Aldana, just because of the fact that if Holly Holm wins, I want to see her in a title fight again. And then lastly, and I can't believe this is even a fight, Mike Perry, Mickey Gall, because look at who Mickey Gall's fought in his short MMA career. It's insane. You can make a movie about that guy. And Mike Perry is a wild man.
I'm going to take an interesting approach to this. Initially, I'm just going to play off of what you did. Initially, what I was going to do was I was going to go to each fight and say, okay, what's the fight that I got to see? That's one, then I'll eliminate it. Then, okay, what's the next fight that I got to see? Then I'll eliminate it. I'm not going to do that. I'm going to take a look at yours and go from there. So I'm going to switch up with you. I got to see Khabib Gaethje because I've never seen it, right? I've seen Miocic Cormier twice. And I do understand your logic. But if that's going to be my logic, then I need to continue with it and make number two, surprisingly, Usman Burns. I do not think that Gilbert Burns is going to give – I think he's going to give a better fight than you do. I don't think he's going to win, but I think he's going to give a better fight than you do. After that, I'm going to go with – Jan and Aldo. After that, I'm going to go with Holm and Aldana because I'm very interested to see what comes of Amanda Nunes we talked about earlier after that fight. So then I'm going to start to get into the fights that I have seen, right? So I'm going to go with Miocic and Cormier. I'm going to go with Holloway and Volkanovski. I'm going to go with Brunson and Shabazian, and then I'm going to go with Mickey Gall and Mike Perry. So I see where you're coming from, but I'm getting juiced up for these fights that I haven't seen.
So to throw a curveball into there, and this is one that's been talked about. They said they were going to fight. They accepted it, whatever, and everybody said it was too soon. Colby Covington, Tyron Woodley, where does that rank? Top three, bottom three, in the middle? If you asked me that question in 2018, I would have said top three out of all of these fights. If you're asking me in 2020, it's like mid to low on my totem pole.
It's weird because sometimes when you want something and you don't get it, you continue to want it. For the example being like Anderson Silva and George St. Pierre. Some people have closed the book on that. I would watch Anderson Silva and George St. Pierre fight each other. They're both 50. They both wanted to come back like Mike Tyson. I'm in.
Yeah, but what if it was like Chuck and Tito 3?
I hear you. I was at Chuck and Tito 3, so you're preaching to the choir. So I had to go. So anyway, my point is that I feel like I would have it higher than maybe I should have it. But, man, I feel like Colby Covington is so far past Tyron Woodley right now that that's not a fight I want to see. I don't want to see Woodley take that beating from a guy that I know he doesn't like and fans don't like. I'm not into that from that perspective.
Fair.
All right, Craig, let's give shouts to MMA Reddit. Let's start the conversation. I have an interesting one for you this week. I have an interesting one for you each week, but this one kind of came out of a weird place. amid all the Dana White, Dominic Foxworth of it all, Max Kellerman made an interesting point. He said that MMA has a middle class and boxing doesn't. That's why the labor issues are so different. I'm going to keep this intro very short and sweet. What is your take on Kellerman saying that MMA has a middle class? What does that mean for MMA? And how does that going to, how's it going to affect labor? What does it mean for boxing? What's your take on Kellerman's assertion as a middle class MMA?
I don't know enough about boxing and boxing cards, but I know just a little bit that might help me in this answer. So if you look at UFC 250 and the reported payouts, I'm going to go the first fight on the prelims, and then I'm going to go with some of the main card. So first fight on the prelims, Herbert Burns got 12-12 to win. Evan Dunham got 60,000, but, you know, long time vet. I get it. I'll throw another one out there. Like Alonzo Menifield got 14, which would have been 14-14. Charles Byrd, 12. Maki Pitola was 10-10. Then I go to the main card. Sean O'Malley, 40-40. Eddie Wineland, 46. Neil Magny, 79-79. Rocco Martin, 48. All the way up to Nunes, who was 350 plus 100,000 for win bonus. Does she get pay-per-view points? Does she get one of those kickback checks, whatever you want to call it? I don't know. Felicia Spencer, 125,000. And then everybody else is kind of there, like Stamen, 36-36. Mearshart, 33. Chase Hooper, 27. So you've got men and women that are making 12. Then you have your 20s, your 30s, the 50s, the 40s, and then as the, like the lower you are on the card, you don't get paid much at all. The middle, and then the higher bit. And it's like that pretty much every card. But in boxing, from what I understand and from what I've seen, you have those squirrely title fights that, do they mean anything? Probably not, but there's a title involved, WBO, WBC, IBF, whatever it is. There's a lot of fighters on there that I've never heard of. And again, I'm such a casual boxing fan that I'll watch a boxing card if it's Alexander Usyk, if it's Anthony Joshua, Tyson Fury, Deontay Wilder, my favorite Canadian fighter that's not Adonis Stevenson. Who is it? You know who it is?
Tell me.
Not Arturo Gatti. Bermain Stiverne. Big Bermain Stiverne fan. But apart from those guys, there's not much in it for me. So from the MMA perspective, there certainly is a middle class. Plus you have the fan favorites that get paid a decent chunk of change, but you always have those fighters like the Neil Magny, 79-79. You have those guys that grind it out for, it's not base pay at 10-10 or 12-12, but it's not champ pay at 250. I'm assuming Max Kellerman, being a boxing guy, will know a lot more about the boxing side of it than he would the MMA side. So if I can put two and two together, I think he's right.
Well, I'm going to use an example that I've heard often, which is the movie industry. And it's been said that in the movie industry, the middle of the road movies aren't getting made anymore. It's indie flicks for a lot, not that much money, that end up blowing up, and it's Marvel movies, right? So for example, movies that you would see, like someone you don't see very much anymore, and it could be because of her age, but like you don't see a lot of Julia Roberts movies coming out where she's just the star and the movie probably costs $40 million, 20 million of it goes to Julia Roberts. You don't see like Aaron Brockovich or Notting Hill or those kind of movies anymore. Because you could end up risking $40 million on a movie that makes $28 million, and that's what they're concerned about, as opposed to making sequels where you already know what you have. So I think that in boxing, the way they do it is they make it so that, you know, the big fighters are the Marvel movies. And everyone else is just trying to be a Marvel movie, right? So you're a guy like Kevin Smith, who made Mallrats, and the next thing you know, you're writing the script for Superman, or you're writing the script for what. So your goal is to go from, you know, Mallrats and Clerks and all that to this huge thing. Now, he's been around for a while, so he's been through the whole thing. But I think with MMA, it's like, you know, they sell the American dream. They have more fighters that think they're going to be Conor McGregor. And as a result, they, you know, the guys that think they can be Floyd Mayweather are few and far between in boxing. The guys that think they're going to be Deontay Wilder, or they think they're going to be Tyson Fury, you know, they understand the economics and they know who they are, right? And there was guys forever in boxing. Their job was to go out and get their ass whipped by Tyson Fury. That's what their job is. Or Mike Tyson or whomever. And they, yeah, they're going to go out there and they're going to be a warm body and they're going to put forth some effort. But you don't see that as much as in MMA, where the understanding is that I'm going to go out there and I'm a stepping stone for this guy.
And the perfect example of this argument is the card that's coming up this weekend. Like, if you ask one of those, you know, fan, no, and no offense, and if you're listening to this, I apologize. And if this gets clipped, this is going to be bad, so don't clip it. But if you watch this card this weekend, you ask somebody on Facebook or on Instagram, hey, who's fighting in the co-main event? You think they could tell you? Do they think they could tell you that it's Carl Roberson and Marvin Vettori? Did you know the answer off the top of your head? It's not one of those cards that's, you know, stacked and there's a ton of name value. And even in the main event, I know Jessica Ai, there was an interview on MMA Junkie today where she addressed the haters saying that it was a bad card. But by normal standards for a fight night card, it's a bad card. But you have a lot of those. It's not like absolute no names, but it's kind of like middle of the road. And I guess I get excited. It's on the Luis Smolka scale. It's pretty low on the butthole puckering scale.
You know what I've always been fascinated by, and we'll kind of, I don't know about end on this, but because it might spring something in your brain, but it's always fascinated me that fighters expend more energy talking about the haters of their card than promoting the card. Like, if you got a hot microphone, who wants to, why talk about the haters? Talk about Calvillo, you know, blast her, or talk about Dana, or talk about Connor, or talk about anything you think. I mean, talk about anything you think is going to get interest in this fight. Don't talk about the haters.
Jessica has done that. It didn't work. I mean, she got a title shot. She got knocked out.
No, I'm talking about for this car. I know what you're saying. I'm talking about for this particular week. You know, Chael says.
Yeah, but the boy who cried wolf and nobody's going to listen.
Maybe, but you gotta try. It certainly does more for you than talking about the haters.
You're right.
All right, guys, there you have it. The fourth episode of Early Stoppage on Fight Night Picks is in the books. Be sure and comment under the video. Let us know what you'd like to see next from the show here on YouTube. Feel free to blast me so that next week I can talk about the haters. You can follow us again on YouTube, also on iTunes and Spotify. Craig can be followed at Craig Allen FFP. I can be followed at SM Cornerman. The fight has been stopped. We'll see you next week. Craig, say something weird.
John, as we always say on Fight Night Picks, let's get into it.